Well, we have all had situations in our lives where someone has done or said something to us that, except for our Christian values, we would have taken the worldly standpoint. We would have either gotten angry or tried to get even. It's a very common thing. But a course for a Christian is not to do this, because every step that we take, every action that we take, is going to have a recompense, isn't it? If it's a good step, if it's something in harmony with our consecration vow, then we'll have a blessing. But if it's something wrong, something that the Lord does not approve, there's going to be a recompense. Paul lays this law down for us in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Would you turn there with me? Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. He says, "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." Every action has a reaction. This is a principle of justice, dear brethren. Justice in rendering due to whom it is due. In the case of something wrong or something evil, then the principle is retributive justice. That is, justice will be done in a way that reflects the original offense. In the book of Genesis, there is a string of such behavior, a string of deception for deception, which occurs to several individuals during the life of Jacob. It contains some remarkable lessons, because it teaches the lesson of retributive justice. In these deceptions that we're going to look at this morning, in each case, there is compensation for the deception that was perpetrated. And it is given along the lines in striking and remarkable similarity to the original offense, showing the fulfillment of the law that Paul laid down here. Now, in the Old Testament, the concept of justice is one that is constantly reiterated. Like for like was a byword of the law. However, once the requirements of justice are met, then mercy and love must prevail. Remember, in our own case, we have been alienated from God through the fall of Adam. There was a requirement of justice in order to bring us back. The death of Jesus met that requirement, provided that atoning sacrifice. Now that we have been brought back, now that justice is satisfied, mercy and love must prevail in our lives. This principle is no less important when we're dealing with one another. Turn to Matthew chapter 5, please. Verses 23 and 24. Matthew chapter 5, verses 23 and 24. Jesus' counsel there, he says, "Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift." So we must make sure that we render what is expected by our brethren of us to them. We have certain requirements. We must make sure that we meet those requirements. But on our side, we must not demand that our brethren give to us what we think is due. We must be satisfied at times with not being rendered full justice, and be forgiving and merciful and understanding about it. Jehovah himself is a very strict bookkeeper when it comes to justice and injustice. And the scales of justice will always, always balance in the finality. And this is true even if those scales of justice have to be balanced within the millennium itself. Notice this in Paul's letter to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 24 and 25. He shows how justice will be balanced. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 24 and 25. And he writes there, "Some men's sins are open beforehand, going before to judgment, and some they follow after. Likewise also the good works of some are manifest beforehand, and they that are otherwise cannot be hid." So Paul wants us to understand that there will be a recompense for every good deed and every bad deed that men do. The string of events in the life of Jacob are the lesson we'd like to consider in retributive justice. Brethren, since we are supposed to be being in training at this time to be judges of the world of mankind, we ought to pay very close attention to these lessons along the lines of justice and recompense. Because not only is justice being balanced and met, but people are being trained. Characters are being developed. And we will see this. As we said, our study centers around the life of Jacob and his family. And all of these deceptions for deceptions that we will evaluate and look at have to do with family members. Let's begin by turning our Bibles to Genesis chapter 25. We'd like to pick up a little bit of information about the background of Jacob and Esau. Now, much of this will be in way of review, so many of these scriptures we're not going to read specifically, but you can follow along as we describe the narratives. In Genesis chapter 25 and verses 22 and 23, we have a description of the prenatal life of Jacob and Esau. You will recall that they were twins. And during the pregnancy of their mother, there was this wrestling, this struggling that was going on within her. And concerned about that, she went to inquire of the Lord why this was happening. In verse 23, we read, "And the Lord said unto her, Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the older." Thus Rebekah, even before her children were born, knew something about their future. Now, we're not told in the scriptures whether she told anyone about this revelation. She may have, she may not have. But she did know it. Now, in verses 24 through 28, we have the birth and growth of the boys. And from the very start, from the very birth, we see that the name Jacob, which means supplanter, was suggested by circumstances surrounding the birth. Do you remember when she gave birth, Jacob was holding onto the heel of his brother, as if to trip him up, as if to supplant. That action was already begun very early in his life. As the boys grow, the scriptures give us a character sketch of them. Esau was the hunter and outdoorsman. Jacob was the shepherd and domesticated one. Now we'd like to look at, in verse 29 through 30, the selling of the birthright. We'd like to evaluate this very closely. This does not begin the string of deceptions. We do not believe that the selling of the birthright was deceptive in any manner. Deception is intended to hide something, to keep something covered. That did not take place in this transaction. Jacob appreciated the importance and value of the birthright, while Esau did not. Let's just review for a moment what the firstborn rights and privileges were under the patriarchal system. Well, first of all, the firstborn had an authority that the other children did not possess, an authority and, in a sense, a superiority over the rest of the family. Secondly, he would receive a double portion of the family inheritance. Thirdly, he was really the priest of the family, wasn't he, under the patriarchal system? So he was in charge of the worship, as all of the patriarchs were. And fourthly, the firstborn would receive a special blessing or benediction from the father. And this was very valuable because it represented the acknowledgement of the father of this special status of the firstborn. Therefore, it was very important. Jacob appreciated these importances. So he struck a deal, and it was a legitimate deal. Esau agreed to it. He didn't have any appreciation or any thought about what it meant or what it was valuable to him, and so he agreed. In fact, the scriptures say that Esau despised his birthright. Now, that's a very strong word, but Paul uses very strong words in describing this despising that Esau had. Keeping your hand in Genesis, let's take a quick look over at Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, and we would like to look at verses 15 through 17. Paul writes there, "Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person, as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For ye know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears." So this is a very strong description of Esau, showing that he was, in essence, unfit for receiving that blessing. Now we'd like to go to Genesis chapter 27, the beginning of the string of deception for deception. In Genesis chapter 27, we have a description of Jacob's stealing the blessing intended for the birthright from his father Isaac. Now we use the word steal guardedly here, because as we have already seen, Jacob was the rightful heir of that blessing. It was legitimately his. A transaction had been made. But did Jacob go about receiving and getting this blessing the correct way? Well, the answer is no. There are several items involved here that we are sure the Lord could not approve. And we're going to look at this and consider whether or not the Lord, in fact, did approve it. Now, one thing we should note is that as you go through the description of this stealing of the birthright, we find that Rebekah was really the brains behind the operation. Consider, it is Rebekah who overhears the request of Isaac to Esau to go get some venison for him. Over here, was she eavesdropping perhaps? Well, we don't know. She's the one that formulates the deceptive plan. Rebekah tells Jacob to obey her in this. Twice she tells him to obey her. Rebekah says if it fails, let the curse be on her. It is Rebekah that cooks up the meal of goat's meat. Interesting, not venison, but goat's meat. We'd like to point out some interesting connections with that as we go on. And finally, it is Rebekah that puts Esau's clothes and the goat skin on Jacob. So she is the moving force behind this. In fact, Jacob seems to be a little reluctant about the whole affair. Notice in verses 11 and 12 of Genesis chapter 27 what Jacob says. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver, and I shall bring a curse upon me and not a blessing." Now, he has some reservations about this whole affair. However, the bottom line is that Jacob joins in with Rebekah in this deception, to the point of lying three times to his father. In verse 19, Jacob said unto his father, "I am Esau, thy firstborn." That was a lie, a deception. In verse 20, he does it again. And Isaac said unto his son, "How is it thou hast found it so quickly, my son?" This is with regard to the meat. And he said, "Because the Lord thy God brought it to me." No, it wasn't the Lord his God, it was his mother. Verse 24, the third lie. And he said, "Art thou my very son Esau?" And he said, "I am." So three times Jacob lies to his father. The deception is very clear. However, the deception is successful. He receives the blessing in verse 28 and 29. He gets what should have been his from the very beginning, but the method by which he obtains it is a deceptive method. Almost immediately thereafter, in verse 30, the deception is exposed. We read, "And it came to pass, as soon as Isaac had made an end of blessing Jacob, and Jacob was yet scarce gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting." Timing here was very crucial, wasn't it? But as soon as Esau came in and identified himself, Isaac realized what had happened. Now let's review once again the question. Did God approve of Rebekah and Jacob's method of obtaining this blessing? Now you can search the scriptures. You will find no discrete word of displeasure recorded in the scriptures about this affair. But on the other hand, we can hardly suppose or hardly assume that the Lord would approve of lying and deception, even to do something which is right. You know, there's a saying in the world, the ends justifies the means. Well, the only one in the universe that can be true for is Jehovah God, the Creator. It can never be true for us. We cannot sacrifice principle to attain something good. We cannot lie just in order to do something right. And so we would say that the lesson here is not a giving of permission for this type of thing, but we feel that God was displeased by this, and we think that subsequent events that happened to Jacob and Rebekah prove it. Deceptions which follow refer right back to this original starting deception and make the connection between the two the same. Well, how is justice served? We're going to look at Jacob in a moment, but first let's just consider Rebekah. She was the moving force behind this. How was it that she got her recompense for this lie and this action? Well, we have to infer something here. This is the last time in the scriptures that Rebekah appears in the narrative. She never appears again. And the implication, we believe, is very strong that she never saw her son after this event. When he fled because of the anger of Esau, it would appear that she never saw her son again. And this would appear, at least for her, part of the recompense. Now we're going to jump to chapter 29 of Genesis. A deception, this time, of the deceiver. A deception for deception. You remember the story. Jacob finds his way to his relative, his uncle, Laban. And he falls in love with one of Laban's daughters, Rachel. Rachel is a beautiful girl, and very quickly, Jacob is attracted to her. So he makes a deal with Laban. I will serve you for 7 years if you give me Rachel to wife. Well, Laban is very in favor of this. He's a member of the household. Certainly, I would be very happy to do that. So the 7 years of labor goes on, and the scripture says it was but a day. Such was his love for Rachel. Then comes the wedding night. Do you remember what happens? A switcheroo takes place. He works for 7 years to have Rachel to wife, but then Laban exchanges Leah for Rachel. Now, I want you to see something here very important. The firstborn was exchanged for the secondborn. Does that ring any bells? Is there any connection, do you see, where Jacob was involved in the same type of switcheroo? Look at verse 26 in Genesis chapter 29. Laban says there's a rule here. It must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Well, Laban never lied to Jacob about it. He just didn't tell him this rather important principle. And the switch takes place. We'd like to put this in a very succinct way. The man who took away the firstborn privilege of his brother now suffered because of the firstborn privilege of his beloved sister. In both cases, there was a deception, and in both cases, there was the switching of a firstborn for the secondborn, or a secondborn for the firstborn. A deception for deception. Well, it doesn't end here. Perhaps Jacob had some objections to this deception that took place. And so sometime later, in fact, in the next chapter it's recorded, he perpetrates a deception. Now, this is some 7 years after that. You remember that he works another 7 years in order to have Leah as a wife. But now at the end of this 14 years, there has to be another arrangement made between he and Laban. He's no longer working for wives. Now he needs to work for something more substantial for himself and for his families. So there's an arrangement made whereby Jacob now can obtain certain parts of the flock of his father Laban. If the characteristics of the animals are a certain way, then they would become Jacob's. If they were the normal way, they would continue to be Laban's. Now, Laban undoubtedly thought that this would be an arrangement that would benefit him. He had been a shepherd for many years and could easily have seen what the proportions of these changes and this coloration on these animals were. So he probably figured, well, that's a 10% or 20% or 5% or whatever. It's a very low percentage. I'll give that to my son-in-law and I'll do fine. Well, Jacob either knew something or discovered something, fell upon a way to produce the changes in the animals. He found a way to change the characteristics so that those percentages were changed. And after some time, now the flock starts to become a majority of Jacob's and a minority of Laban's. Well, this is very interesting. Now, again, we can read this in Genesis chapter 30, verses 28 through 43. We're not going to look at the verses. I'm sure you remember the details. But there is an irony here that is much more plain in the Hebrew tongue, and it's not very plain in English. Remember that Laban had deceived Jacob over Rachel and Leah. Jacob now, in turn, is deceiving Laban back by getting his ewes and rams, among other animals. But I'd like to focus on ewes and rams. In Hebrew, the word for ewes is Rahelium, which is Rachel. The Hebrew word for rams is Elam, which is a twist on the word Leah, on the name Leah. So for Laban's having deceived Jacob by substituting Leah for Rachel, Laban is now repaid by losing his ewes and rams, his Rachels and Leahs. Here again, the payback contains a hint of the original offense. Now we're going to go on a little bit further. There's another deception that takes place. Now you recall when the change of Leah and Rachel took place, how do you think Rachel felt about it? We focused on Jacob's reaction, but do you think she was very happy about this change? Well, we can imagine not. So she's got maybe a little bit of a grudge against her father too. She wants to maybe repay and get back at him in some way. Well, there comes a time when Jacob's family and flocks have grown large enough when he wishes to leave the household of Laban, wants to strike out on his own. When he leaves, Rachel does something which is underhanded, which is wrong. She steals something very valuable from her father. She steals Laban's household icons, his teraphim. Now, these were a representation of the wealth and prosperity of the family. They may have been involved in some worship of idols as well. But the point here is that they were very important. 3 days later, Laban discovers this. And the loss aggravates him terribly, so he chases after the whole family of Jacob. And after 10 days, he catches them. Now, when Laban tells Jacob about this, Jacob is sympathetic. He's lived with this man for a long time, and Jacob has very high values. He understands what a loss this is to his father-in-law. So he does something unwittingly. He unwittingly curses his wife. Turn to Genesis chapter 31 and read verse 32 with me. With whomever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. Before our brother discern what is thine with thee, and take it with thee. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. Let him not live. That's a terrible curse. And unfortunately and unwittingly, it comes to lie on Rachel. Well, Laban starts to search the camp, and he's unable to find it. Eventually, he comes to Rachel, who has hidden the teraphim in her saddlebag, and then sat upon it. Now, when Laban reaches her tent, she says to him, let it not displease my lord, I cannot rise before thee. This is in verse 35, incidentally. For the custom of women is upon me. And he searched, but found not the images. Now, what does she mean, the custom of women? Well, evidently, Rachel was lying about her menstruation. She did not want to move because of this normal, cyclic, periodic, monthly thing with women. Jacob, remember now, has unwittingly cursed her with death. This provides two items of ironic and tragic consequences. She, number one, is already cursed with death, but number two, having hidden the teraphim under the guise of this menstruation, it is very interesting that just four chapters later, Rachel dies, remember the curse, in childbirth, remember the lie. The connection between childbirth and the normal arrangement of the women's system to bear children provides a very tragic and very intense connection. So once again, we have a deception, and then we have a recompense to it. We see a parallel between the original deception and the consequences. Let us go on. There is yet one more deception of Jacob, a second deception that takes place when his family has grown to quite an extent. Now we might ask the question, why a second deception? He already had one deception upon him, and we saw the connections between his deception of his father. Why a second one? Well, we'd like to suggest that justice had not been served, and more importantly, that character development of Jacob had not yet taken place. In that deception that was perpetrated upon him first, the consequences were very minor. He simply didn't have Rachel on his wedding night, but he got her very shortly thereafter. So it was a minor inconvenience. the lesson of recompense might not have been laid upon him very strongly. But now we have a second deception, which is very, very strong. In fact, produces great mental anguish in Jacob. This, of course, is in connection with Joseph. Now, just to step back for a minute, give you a little bit of a review. You recall that when Joseph was born, he was the youngster of the family, and the other 10 brothers did not have a very great deal of love for him. At one point, Joseph has this dream in which he sees his brothers serving him. And so angry are they that at one point they begin to plot his murder. Now, if it weren't for the action of two of the brothers, that might have taken place. Reuben, the firstborn, was very much against it, and so suggests something which would sort of deflect the anger of the brethren, and he thought that he could save his brother later. That plan didn't work out. Judah, finally, in trying to save his brother's life, suggests that they sell him as a slave, at least to conserve his life. And they do this. But there was this hatred, very much. But remember what they did after he was sold as a slave to deceive Jacob. They took his coat and dipped it in goat's blood and then brought it to Jacob. They ask him, "Do you recognize this?" He does, and he draws the wrong conclusion. His son Joseph has been rent by a wild beast. This is in Genesis 37:33. This is a very difficult deception. Very much suffering was evoked by this. And incidentally, we'd like to point out one item here, too, that there seems to be this sub-theme of goats and garments. Now, we've been looking at this subject for about 3 years, and I'm still not sure what all the connections are here. I believe there's a lot more. But remember the goat and the garment back in the first? Now we have the deception of Jacob by this death, or the assumed death of Joseph. You have, once again, a garment and goat's blood. That's what was placed upon it. So there's a goat and garment sub-theme that we're going to see one more time in the string of deceptions as well. So the items of parallel that make us think, once again, of the very first deception are very strong in these. Incidentally, there seems to be some puns in the Hebrew along these lines as well. The word for goat in Hebrew is seer. Seir is also the name of the place where Esau settled, Genesis 33:16. But the word for hairy in Hebrew, which is descriptive of Esau, is Seir. They're very, very close, almost giving us a double pun of reminder of that original deception. Now let us go on. There's another deception found in Genesis 38 that has to do with Judah. This one is very interesting as well. Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Marries a girl by the name of Tamar, but the scriptures record the fact for us that he's wicked, and so the Lord puts him to death. Now, under the patriarchal system and under the law later on, there was an arrangement by which a man, if he died without offspring, could be assured of continuing offspring for his family. And so one of the brothers would marry the widow, and thus raise up offspring in the name of the dead parent. So the second, Onan, is given to Tamar as a husband in order to raise up offspring for Er. But he refuses to do this. Perhaps he's worried about his inheritance. We don't know, other than that his motives are wrong. And so he too is killed by God. So now that leaves Shelah, the third son. Well, now put yourself for a moment in Judah's shoes. Here this girl Tamar comes, she marries your first son, he dies. She marries your second son, he dies. Now, it would normally be correct for her to marry the third son. Would you be worried? Judah was. He was very concerned about this. So what he does is he tells Tamar, "Well, Sheila's not quite old enough yet. We'll do it sometime later." Well, later comes, and later goes. Time passes by, and Shelah is not given to Tamar as a husband. Now, Tamar has had a great injustice done to her. Under both the patriarchal system and the law, the bearing of children was the right of a woman. And it was very important because of the agricultural arrangement at that time. Having sons, having a family was vitally important. So Judah is deceiving her. He made a promise that he didn't intend to keep. So eventually Tamar comes to an appreciation of what Judah is doing. So now she takes action. She poses as a harlot on the road. Judah, evidently newly widowed, propositions her and sleeps with her, promising to pay her one goat. Now, as a pledge for the payment, since he didn't have a goat in his spare suit, he leaves some articles of his clothing, some articles of his garmentry. We're told a signet, a bracelet, and his staff. Now, this is his pledge that he will come back and pay her what she owes him. Amazingly enough, Judah never recognizes her during this encounter. Well, what is the result? Well, he tries to pay her, but there's nowhere to be found. And no one knows anything about a harlot on the road at that point. Well, some 3 months later, Tamar is found to be pregnant. Look at Genesis chapter 38, verse 24. And it came to pass about 3 months later that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth, let her be burnt. This was a terrible scandal on the family. Must take care of this right away. Well, what does Tamar do? Look at the next verse there. When she was brought forth, she said to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, I am with child. And said, discern, I pray, whose are these, the signet, the bracelets, and the staff. Recognize these? Judah does. And realize that she has done righteously. In fact, he says that in the next verse. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she hath been more righteous than I, because I gave her not to Shelah my son. He recognized that what she did was not wrong. It was just. It was justice that he owed her and had not paid. Now, there are some interesting parallels here, which, of course, is the constant theme in all of these deceptions for deceptions. Judah deceived her because he lost two sons. Tamar deceived him back because she had zero sons. But you know how many sons that she got out of this encounter? Two. Judah receives two sons back, as it were replacements for those that were lost in death, the wicked sons. Tamar receives justice, and we have some wonderful parallels. Incidentally, did you notice that curious reappearance of the goat and garment sub-theme again? The goat, the payment, and those articles of clothing and decoration that Judah had that had given her as a token. Again, I can't tell you what it all means. It's wonderful, and it's probably a theme for further fellowship and further study. Well, now we're going to move to some 13 years later. We're going to look at the last deceptions, the deceptions that close off this whole string. For this, we're going to refer back to Joseph. Since Joseph had been sold in slavery, many things had happened. He had risen to extraordinary power in Egypt. When we say extraordinary power, brethren, we want you to understand that second to Pharaoh is where Joseph was. And in some sense, he was even above Pharaoh. I had a verse showed to me in fellowship this weekend, which I appreciate very much and I never saw before. Genesis chapter 45 and verse 8. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler throughout the land of Egypt. Focus on father to Pharaoh. Brother Rush Shalou and I were talking about Egyptian history somewhat the other night. And Russ pointed out something which I think most of us probably knew in the background, that it was a frequent occurrence in Egypt for a boy to be Pharaoh on the throne. Remember King Tut, Tutankhamun, the boy king? This was not an unusual thing. The implication that this verse gives us, and some of the Egyptian history seems to bear this out, the Pharaoh on the throne when Joseph rose to power was a boy. And that the relationship that developed between Joseph and this boy Pharaoh was, as Scripture says here, as a father unto a son. Now we bring this out just to emphasize what a powerful man Joseph was in the land of Egypt, and why, when his brothers came before them, they were trembling and shaking in their sandals. Well, the brothers do come in. Chapter 42 and verse 10. They're standing there before them, and they're very worried because they have been accused, perhaps, of being spies. And notice the expression they use. And they said, "Nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come." Here's irony number one. They were referring to Joseph as thy servants, the very man that they had sold in slavery. Well, Joseph doesn't reveal himself to them right away. He chooses rather to be a little bit deceptive, to try them, to see if there has been any growth in the many years that have taken place since their absence. So he proposes a test. First of all, he accuses them as spies. He wants them to know what fear means, to know what it means to be helpless and not in control of circumstances, the very conditions he was in. Then he says, "So you have another younger brother at home yet. I want you to go and get that brother and bring him back to me. But first, I want you to spend 3 days in jail." So he throws them in the clink. What do they do in this condition? Where do their minds drift? Look at verses 21 and 22. "And they said to one another, 'We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is the distress come upon us.' And Reuben answered, saying, 'Spake I not unto you, saying, Do not sin against the child? And ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required.'" Reuben is one of those that says, "I told you so." So their minds now have been brought to the injustice that they did much earlier, the injustice to him, and the deception they perpetrated on their father. Finally, Joseph lets them go, but he keeps one. He keeps Simeon. "I'm going to keep Simeon in jail while you go off." Just as a footnote, we think it's very appropriate that Simeon should be the one selected to be kept in jail in this rather oppressive condition while the rest go. Think about the order of birth. We have the firstborn, Reuben. Reuben, if you look at the account of Joseph, it's very clear that Reuben did not want this to happen. But he was absent when the whole event actually took place. Who's the second in line? Simeon. Now remember, under the patriarchal system, there was a great deal of attention placed upon the order of births, upon eldership, as it were. So Simeon, as the oldest brother during that whole affair with Joseph, would have been the one responsible. And the implication, the fact that Joseph keeps him, is that he was, in fact, the one that was pushing for this whole affair to either kill Joseph or do terrible things to him. So there's a little justice being served here as well, with Simeon being the one that's kept behind. Furthermore, when Joseph sends the brothers back, there's 9 brothers going back now, he not only gives them their food, but he returns the money that they paid. 9 measures of silver, 1 for each of the saddlebags, he returns and puts back in. Now when they find that, oh, the fear that comes upon them, it's going to appear as if we stole this food. The money's back. It's interesting that when the brothers return, they bring Benjamin, and then all 11 of them go off again, and Joseph does the same thing again. Do you recall? He puts the money back, except 11 measures of silver. I want you to think about something for a moment. 9 plus 11. What does that add up to? 20. How much was Joseph sold for? 20. So these brothers, they received 20 measures of silver back, just as they had the first time, but under very different circumstances. Now the receiving of the money brought trembling and fear upon them because they were afraid of what it represented. So we have yet one more ironic and just recompense. Incidentally, another footnote. Joseph was sold for 20 measures of silver, 20 pieces of silver. This is supposed to be a reflection upon Jesus, but Jesus was sold for 30. Why the difference? Well, the difference was because of Joseph's age. The price of a slave for a young one like that was 20. The price of a slave for a mature man was 30. So the idea was that the price was the same, it was just the difference in age. Finally, Joseph gathers his brethren before him, and he reveals who he is. There is joy for a moment, but there's a little concern. You can imagine, here's Joseph, the one that all of these things were perpetrated on. What's he going to do to us? Joseph had the power. He could have done anything that he wanted to them, and may even have been just in doing so. But what does he choose to do? "I forgive you. The Lord meant this for a blessing to our whole family, so I forgive." Isn't that interesting? It is forgiveness, it is love that brings an end to this string of deception for deception. Remember the expression, love covers a multitude of sins? Brethren, so often we have seen in the world, and unfortunately at sometimes among the brethren, there is these burdens that we bear because someone did something or said something to us in the past. And maybe we hold back fellowship a little bit. And maybe we don't reach out when we should. The lesson here, brethren, is forgiveness and love. That puts an end to any bad feelings. Well, brethren, there are many lessons that we would have liked to have considered in this. We'd like to close with a scripture in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. 1 Thessalonians 4, 6 and 7. Paul writes there that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we have forewarned you and testified. God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness. God is the avenger. He will avenge. He will recompense. He will settle the scales of justice. So, brethren, may we, in our relationship with one another, may we deal with injustices that might be perpetrated against us in a loving and forgiving manner. May we always make sure that if we have anything naught against our brethren, that we take care of it quickly, with love and with understanding. This is what is required of those that will judge the human race. This is what is required of the body of Christ. We have many opportunities to do this. May we together encourage one another, brethren, to do this. May we keep the lessons of retributive justice and deception for deception in mind. And may we help and aid one another to be more like Christ in all of our dealings. May the Lord bless this to you.